From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Albany, finally, when the legislative session came to a merciful close. And in 2015, it's notable both for what did and did not happen. Tax rebates, funding for anti-poverty initiative, an official fracking ban, done. The DREAM Act, MMA, changes to the SAFE Act, not done. This hour, Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli joins me in studio recapping what happened and responding to some of your questions and phone calls. And if you want to call the program this hour, you can do it. It's toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I thought you guys were never going to end that session.
You know, there were moments where I was afraid we were never going to end that session. I'm not going to lie. But, you know, it's interesting. Years ago, going a little more than a week beyond the scheduled end of the session would not have even made the news because it was such a frequent occurrence. But in the last several years, we've not only obviously done the budgets on time, but the session has ended literally on the day it was projected to end. So this was a little bit unusual, but you know, warranted given the number of things that we were trying to deal with at the end of session.
And there's plenty to talk about this hour, but this is one of those sessions where there's maybe not one huge headline that leads the way. What to you is the biggest story that came out of the session?
Well, actually, I think, the big headline is the leadership changes in both the Senate and the Assembly, which are not only unprecedented in the same year, but unprecedented in the manner in which they both happened. So that was really, in my mind, the thing that distinguished this session and the way that legislators on both sides of the aisle in both houses, in my view, successfully dealt with those changes. And, you know, people expected perhaps the place to just dissolve into chaos, and that clearly did not happen, I don't think, in either house. So, you know, I think it talks about the resiliency, something that wouldn't really be talked about very much, of the men and women who serve in the legislature.
All right, fair enough. Well, then we'll start there because you were, I have to think, very close to being in that leadership position as the speaker. And, of course, Carl Hastie ends up in that position, someone you've known at least decently well, I think, for a number of years.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's a little bit of an irony that Carl and I, probably the person I had one of the closest relationships in the legislature for the 15 years that he served prior to his elevation as speaker. And he and I talked both in the run-up to Speaker Silver stepping aside and Carl's election, talked every day about how we have always been partners and friends, partly because of our work in the legislature, partly because we had the distinction of just a couple of us who served both in a governmental capacity as members of the legislature and committee chairs, but also we chaired our local county political party. So we've had a long bond and, as I said, a great relationship even through the election process. And it was just sort of an irony that we ended up being the two finalists for the job. But our relationship has deepened. I have enormous respect for him. I always have. He's a really honorable guy. And, in his new capacity, needed me to play a much different role than I had in the past.
How different?
Well, I'm now in the room where we're, negotiating the final budget packages, the final package at the end of this session that dealt with the not only rent, but the circuit breaker and the property tax cap, et cetera. So being right with him and being a part of his inner circle as we're going through and strategizing about what we need to do for not only our members, but for what we think is important for the state of New York, really is a departure from the role that I had played in the past. My role previous to this really been the organization and operation of the House on a day-to-day basis. I still do that, but I've added much more to that portfolio.
So the old cliche of three men in a room, is it four men in a room? And I'm not trying to be cheeky. I'm trying to understand how it's working now.
No, I think, certainly Carl represented our interests with the new Senate Majority Leader and the governor. But I was, spent long hours each day with the speaker and our senior staff about what it was that we were attempting to do. And obviously the governor is a friend, and I talked to him multiple times, typically each day, about what was going on. So just try to, represent Rochester's interests and upstate's views in the mix of everything that was going on, and to try to provide good counsel to the speaker and to my colleagues about what we should be doing from the assembly's perspective.
A lot of folks have said that after everything that has happened in terms of ethics violations, arrests, Sheldon Silver, Dean Skelos, that we need to get away from the so-called three men in a room. And on this program in the past, you've said that that was overblown. I know some other critics have said it's not overblown. But going forward, how is it working? Is it working well?
Well, I think it worked very well at the end of session. And there's no question that John Flanagan and Carl Hastie in their new roles provided leadership. But they also provided it differently. I think they involved much more of the rank and file. We had, for instance, Democrat conferences where we go daily with our members and gauge their attitudes on a whole variety of issues. We spent more time in conference this year than I ever remember. And so it was really very much a process where we engaged the rank and file and got viewpoints from, you know, all over the political spectrum, because we represent our conference, probably the most diverse of the four conferences in Albany, politically, in terms of philosophy, geography, race, gender, et cetera. So this was much more of a participatory process. So the speaker represents us in those meetings with the governor and the Senate, but, you know, what I've always said in the past is it relies on participation of the members this year more than any other that I recall.
Okay. And when it comes to ethics reform, remind our listeners the kind of package that did come down. And again, this is a case where you've got some saying, hey, stronger ethics reform than the other saying not strong enough. What happened?
Well, I think we certainly made a number of changes around the personal use of campaign funds. We're working out differences on pension forfeiture. If a legislator or a statewide elected official is deemed to have been violative of his public responsibilities. There are a number of things that we did. But here's what I remind people of. You know, the current ethics laws have worked to some degree because we have both leaders now under indictment, former leaders under indictment, which is, you know, saying something. And I also tell people that it's hard to predict who is going to commit a crime before they do it and who is, susceptible to overtures from folks who should not be engaged in this business. And, you know, we can do everything we can to bolster the ethics laws, and we worked really hard at doing that this year. However, you know, in every industry, in every business, some bad people are going to be attracted to it, and I think that's unfortunate. But on some level, you just can't do anything about it except be vigilant.
Well, here's the headline from Joe Spector, writing for Gannett. 2 hours ago, Malcolm Smith, former Senate Democratic leader, sentenced to 7 years in prison. The former Democratic Senate leader, Malcolm Smith from Queens, sentenced to 7 years in prison today in White Plains for a scheme to bribe his way onto the ballot for New York City mayor in 2013. Just another headline. We're sort of numb to it now. And at the very least, I don't disagree with you, Joe. I agree that every industry has its bad actors. But does New York State politics feel like it has attracted a disproportionately bad number of actors because it has been so easy to grease the skids in some ways, or is that changing now?
Well, I mean, the one thing that obviously it's disheartening for a member of the legislature when you're working hard and trying to do the very best you can to see colleagues be indicted, be convicted, go to prison. And there's a long list since I've been in Albany. I mean, it would be a very long list, sadly. And right now we have at least three legislators under indictment. John Sampson, former Senate Majority Leader, his trial is underway. Tom Libous, who's the Republican floor leader in the Senate, he's under indictment. Dean Skelos is under indictment. Shelley Silver's under indictment. This is incredibly difficult, and I don't know what to say about it. I think part of the nature of politics, whether it's in New York or whether it's in any other state legislature, part of the politics is because you have power, because you have influence, people who are weak or come here with the wrong motivations are going to find opportunities perhaps to violate the public trust. I would say, however, there is a long list of people who have been convicted of crime, so it's not as though it's very easy to get away with. I always scratch my head about two things. One, how do people think this is the right thing to do and it violates your moral sense of what's right and wrong? And secondly, how do they think they're going to get away with it? Because few of them actually do. And I guess that's, in a sense, the good news. And I think no matter how hard we try to address our ethics rules and some other things that we did this year as well, whether or not that discourages people from doing things that are, in violation of the public trust, time will tell. I certainly hope so. But those laws are at least catching people And many of them are going to prison, and frankly, that's where they should be.
All right, and the last word on that before we move to other subjects is, would you have done anything more? Anything that fall short in your mind in any way, ethics reform?
Well, I do think I would like to have seen the pension forfeiture, which I was a sponsor of, that constitutional amendment come to a resolution between the Senate, the governor, and the Assembly. We still have next year to be able to accomplish that and still get that constitutional amendment on the ballot in November of 2017. So I think that was one of the failings of this session, that we weren't able to produce an agreement on that.
We're talking to Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader, in studio for the hour, and we're going to mix in your questions with mine as we go throughout the hour. I'll start on Twitter, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. You can call the program if you want, toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. 263-9994. Moving back through the last hour, let's see here. Todd writes to us, no MMA because Dems alone can't pass it definitely reflects leadership. MMA is the first question from a listener, which is interesting. Joe, for our listeners who go, I still don't fully understand, what's MMA? What's MMA, Joe?
It's athletic competition. It's called mixed martial arts. Yep. It's most people would know the brand UFC, which is one of the promoters.
Ultimate Fighting Championship.
There are others. It's on television every night. We are the only place in North America that doesn't allow it in New York State. It's legal and regulated professionally in Canada, in every province, in all 49 states, in most of Europe. I don't know of almost any place other than France, which has a huge judo, professional judo world out there where it is prohibited. And, you know, this is a bill that I sponsored to not only make it legal, but to regulate it at both the professional and amateur level. And I'm probably getting very close to having the requisite number of votes to pass it. So I think the next time we convene in Albany, I am pretty optimistic that we can get the bill on the floor and get it passed.
Is it a realistic economic boom?
You know, there's certainly for upstate cities like Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and Utica, there will be opportunity. There will be cards. UFC is committed to having upstate cards, as well as obviously their desire to have shows at Madison Square Garden, which is a big world venue. So I think there's the economic value in a community in terms of what it does for, you know, sort of tourism. You know, the advantages to the state in terms of economics, the tax receipts, frankly, are pretty modest. But what I'm more concerned about is the health and safety of people who are participating in the sport right now, doing it at an amateur level and largely doing it in an unregulated way.
Why did Carl Hasty and Sheldon Silver, why have they been opposed to MMA? Talked to them, haven't you?
Yeah, of course. I've talked to the former speaker who just doesn't like the sport. The current speaker actually, I think, would
I don't like NASCAR. I wouldn't ban it.
Yeah, no, that's what I say to people is, look, I just think there are certain things that I like to do and certain things that I would pay money to see. Whether MMA is one of them, you know, that's not material. So when I say to legislators, you know, you're opposed to it, but it goes on, and be better to go on in a regulated manner. We can protect the health and safety of participants. So I think Carl Hasty is very much more open to it. And I think what he has asked me to do is try to make sure that I have enough votes to get it passed. And honestly, as my job as majority leader, my job every day is to make sure we have the requisite number of votes to pass bills on the floor. So I, you know, have to be honest, and I can't have two standards, one for Joe Morelli's legislation and one for everybody else's. So I'm, you know, living under the same requirements that everybody else has. But I think we're pretty close, if not there. And so I'm hopeful when we reconvene, whether it's a special session or in January, that we will finally see it regulated in New York.
You'll like this email from Martin. Martin says, tell the speaker, he's elevated you, tell the speaker it's barbaric. That's why we should be the only state that doesn't pass it. He says it's barbaric. Bob Riley put martial arts, MMA, in the same category as dogfighting, prostitution, and televised executions. Hyperbole to you?
Absolutely. You know, whether people like it or not, there is, boxing is violent in nature. Hockey, many would say, is violent in nature. There are a lot of football is violent in nature. And again, people who find it repugnant just simply don't have to watch it. But to somehow, you know, build a fence or a dome around New York and say, well, our children aren't going to be subjected to it. I mean, frankly, you know, as I say to people, I've watched probably 1,000 football games in my life, but I've probably only been at a handful in person. Same thing with baseball and hockey. I mean, the number of times I've watched it on television far outweighs the number of times I've been to a live competition. And UFC, for instance, is on television every day of the week. So, you know, children in New York, you know, who are interested in it, or adults in New York who are interested, can watch it on television every day. What I'm more concerned about is the health and safety of people who are participating in it. And this has a lot of the legislation not only includes MMA, but boxing as well. And it creates $1 million fund for anyone who's injured or has a brain injury in the ring. We're looking at ways to look at the long-term impacts of repetitive brain injury. Truth is, MMA is probably less impact on someone's brain than boxing does. Boxing, you have a 16-ounce glove which protects your fist and allows you to hit someone in the head repeatedly, and that's really the goal of boxing. Remember, Roberto Duran was ridiculed when he said, no mas, no mas. In MMA, if you're in a bad position, you just tap out and the bout's over, and there's no, shame in doing that. So, look, again, people who don't like it don't have to watch it. People who, and certainly wouldn't go to a competition, but it is the fastest growing sport in America, and there are a lot of young people, both men and women. In fact, the largest draw right now is Ronda Rousey, and Ronda is a woman. So women UFC fighters are now drawing better than some of the men, and we just want to make sure that people are protected and it's regulated.
Talking to Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli, let's turn our attention to the anti-poverty initiative that you have been so involved with, and I think this is... in many ways, this is different than a lot of the efforts I've seen over the years in Rochester for one specific reason. Best I can tell from those involved, and there are a lot of people involved, there is going to be a very public view of the action, the goals, and whether it works or not. I mean, you're really kind of putting your head out there saying, you know, we're determined to try something and we're going to invest and we're hoping it's going to work. It's very ambitious. So let's back up a little bit. What did the state do to assist these efforts? What's going on now?
Well, as you know, I've told the story many times. This effort began probably about a year ago when I worked with Peter Carpino and others at the United Way to go encourage the governor's staff to put more funding into home visitation programs like the Nurse Family Partnership, which has shown real, empirical data that it's helpful in moving people out of poverty. And what the governor's staff said, the senior staff, after we met with them, is let's do something even more audacious. Let's eradicate poverty. Let's set our sights higher. So I took that challenge, came back home, enlisted the support of the county executive and the mayor to partner with me and the United Way, and to really drive an anti-poverty initiative that will be bold. It is probably larger now. You know, for everybody saying you should look around the country and see what everybody else is doing, we're doing that. We have an extensive library of what's going on elsewhere, what is demonstrating some progress and some potential. But this is now, I think, the largest effort of its kind in the country. We have over 100 not-for-profit agencies. We have work groups in six key areas that have 125 people spending a great deal of time and effort. We have a systems design group led by Marlene Bassett of the Catholic Family Center and Kelly Reed, who's the Commissioner of Human Services for the county, to redesign the system. The truth is, right now you have 100 or so different agencies, all siloed, not speaking to one another, not sharing data, and really not in any way able to follow the progress of an individual, a child, an adult, their family, through the cycle of poverty. And so you have really people meeting basic needs, staying essentially on a treadmill, not advancing, not moving from, in a sense, crisis through stability up to self-sufficiency. And that's really what this is designed to do. First of all, to align everyone and get them on the same platform from an IT point of view, from a communications point of view, to enlist the help of mentors and case managers to really make a concerted effort to find out what obstacles keep people from being able to be successful. So, and we're drawing on, we're not only having these work groups that are meeting and really devoting enormous amounts of time. And I'm, very heartened by it and very grateful for the amount of time and energy people are putting into this. So we're hoping to have our work group reports back in the next few days. And then we're going to spend the month of July pulling that together, hopefully into a seamless way that we can create a blueprint for change that will be long lasting, that will be multi-generational.
Yeah, we had Fran Weisberg, among others, on this program recently, and it wasn't a case of, hey, we hope by 2020 we've got our heads around it. This is a, sometime in July, we're going to see some real things happening.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've been very, very aware of is, first, people want us to already know the answer, and yet want people to participate. So you got to strike this balance. We want as broad a participatory effort as possible, and that's why we've engaged a lot of people. We've got a public process. We're going to have a public hearing sometime in July. We will encourage people to come and tell us their story. But by the same token, I want to have a blueprint. And so I'm really pushing people on deadlines. Let's get, high-level recommendations. Let's look at assets we have in this community. Let's look at obstacles. Let's look at ways to measure our success. I'm going to continue to drive this to the extent that I can. And having the partnership with the governor and his task force is critically important because they're partnering with us at looking at ways to create more flexible funding streams, to remove barriers that were never intended to be barriers, but because they've been built in a patchwork over time, they create inconsistencies in law. So, and the governor's impatient. I mean, we work together a lot. I don't know that I've ever met somebody who's quite as impatient about getting things done. And so that's driving me and that's driving this effort.
I talked to someone on this program a few weeks back about this, and they said, you know why this probably won't work? Because there's politicians involved. And they said, eventually, politicians are going to disagree on the ideology behind a proposed solution, and someone is going to back out, someone is going to say no, someone's going to block funding. You know, and the question came up, can whoever the political leaders are, no matter your party, because it's not just Democrats, it's not just you.
That's right.
You know, whatever the work groups say, can you just agree that whatever is proposed, you're willing to say, nothing has worked for years here, so we will try it, even if it goes against a little bit of the grain of my ideology? I mean, are you at a point where, are you concerned that something might get held up because of ideology?
No, I'm not concerned about that at all. I think, first of all, the great thing about this is from corporate leaders to not-for-profit leaders right down to consumers who have actually been in or are continuing to be in crisis, everybody is engaged. Everybody wants to find real solutions. It's not a simple task, obviously. People who are in crisis, people in poverty, often have multiple challenges in their lives. So it's not as simple as saying, well, just get a job or we'll hook you up with a job, go to work. You know, there are daycare issues. There are transportation issues. There are competency issues in terms of skill sets. So there are issues around work ethic and what people's backgrounds have been, and what do they know about going to work every day and showing up on time and not missing work. And there's a lot to do here. So I think it's become big enough that hopefully what will happen is no political leader will want to be seen as being an obstacle to its progress. I don't have an ideology about this. I want this to work. I believe that knitting this together into a real system where people talk and share common data elements, where we bring in not only people who have been in the fight against poverty, but also our educational system, our healthcare system, because individuals have health problems, they have behavioral issues, there are issues related to trauma in their lives and violence. So that's why these work groups are on different topics, but hopefully will be knitted together into a seamless system, and that's why the system redesign is so important as well. So I think political leaders will drive a lot of this in terms of encouraging participation. That's why I think the governor, the mayor, the county executive, myself, other elected officials participating in this and really pushing this helps sort of light the fire. But now it's broad participation, and that's why I think there's real chance for success. It will take resources. I think the $6 million that we were able to bring to bear in the last days of the session for Rochester and hopefully can be used towards the recommendations of these work groups is an indication of how much we believe in this, how much the governor believes in it, and that we really can do something extraordinary here.
As you heard Assembly Majority Leader say, we are days away from some of the first recommendations, and we'll certainly be covering that on this program because things are moving. Let's get our first phone call, and it's Keith in Farmington. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, sorry. Good show. So a couple of things that, for lack of a better word, I find disgusting, appalling, that our legislature needs ethics rules. If they don't know what the hell is ethical by now, they shouldn't even be in office. That's one thing. And if you go through the list of those people under indictment right now, I would willing to bet, I'd bet you lunch on this, but the vast majority of them are attorneys. And is it cause and effect? I don't know, but why does it always seem to be that we have attorneys are the ones that ended up being indicted.
Well, Keith, I would agree with you. Your first sentiment that you expressed, that no matter what laws we have in place, you should just know what's right and wrong. And that goes to my earlier point. We can add more laws, but people should just know what is right and wrong. The second, as it relates to attorneys, I'm not an attorney. I don't even play one on TV. And I don't know that everyone who's been indicted as an attorney, I don't think so. And I would just say that it's probably because just a high percentage of members are attorneys. But I, you know, I wouldn't know anything more beyond that. I think the big issue is when you set up a system where transactions become the order of the day and you act in a transactional way, you're going to get into trouble. I always tell people, look, I believe in relationships, with organizations, with groups that, that seek to have, their voice heard in Albany. Relationships allow you to disagree with people without being disagreeable. My most important relationship is with my wife, and she disagrees with me, you know, every day, all day. But you're allowed to disagree and not be disagreeable when you have relationships. So it's people who really work in a transactional way that I think are the most disturbing. I think create the worst public policy, and I think from time to time those people are drawn to Albany. And I don't know what to say about it other than we're working very hard at rooting them out.
We're going to get a short break and come back with more of your phone calls and questions for Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli. Questions on the minimum wage, the governor's wage board, and so many other things coming up in our second half hour with the Assembly Majority Leader right here on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the march toward women's equality. This week we've seen a couple of big headlines, but are they really helping? For example, the Women's World Cup is getting attention around the world. That's great. But the Brazilian Soccer Federation head says it's because, well, women are prettier than they used to be on the soccer field. We're also talking about women on the $10 bill. Why not the 20? Why not the 1? Join the conversation Thursday.
In med school, healthy eating hasn't been part of the curriculum.
I did a 4-year extra intensive training program in cardiology and didn't receive 1 minute of training in nutrition.
But that's changing.
A quick granola,
banana nut muffin,
breakfast tacos.
Teaching docs to prescribe eating right later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined by Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader. And on Twitter, Laura wants to know, why is it that every idea brought by the local delegation has to go through David Gant first? I didn't know it did.
I don't think that's true. With all due respect, Laura, I'm not sure where she's gotten that. You know, David obviously chairs the Transportation Committee, but he and I have disagreed a number of times in the past. We disagreed over financing of reconstruction of our schools in the city of Rochester last year, and we were successful in getting that done over his objections. You know, he's a member of longstanding, but I dare say I don't think he has veto power over anything that the local delegation is doing. He certainly, you know, as I said, he's an important voice, but we all work together as a delegation often and sometimes individually, so.
Ben said he missed it, wants to know if there was a change in the minimum wage for New York State.
No, we have a current schedule of increases in the minimum wage for the next year. There was talk of adding an additional increase at the end of the schedule, and that did not get adopted by the legislature. We in the Assembly tried to advance that. There have been other proposals.
So you supported a more aggressive minimum wage increase?
Well, not necessarily more aggressive, but an additional a raise at the end
okay.
of the under
I
the
see.
Scheduled one.
So we're at 875 going to, oh man, we're quizzing it now.
Nine, it goes to 9. I don't know what the last iteration is.
So you wanted to see one more step.
One more step, at least with, and we've talked about in the Assembly, we actually did talk about accelerating it. We've also talked about adding a cost of living adjustment to it, so it would be indexed, which really then removes the need for legislation to continue to be introduced or proposed every few years. You would just say, okay, it's $9.50 and it'll be indexed every year at the CPI or some other index, and then you'd see gradual incremental changes. It wouldn't lose its purchasing power vis-a-vis or compared to inflation. So that would remove inflation as a way of eating away at the the buying power, the purchasing power of the minimum wage. There has also been discussion of increasing the minimum wage just in New York City. The Assembly rejected that. The governor has proposed it. Mayor de Blasio has proposed it. You know, I would prefer to have a single minimum wage across the state. I think you could make an argument for New York City and the metro region just because of its size and the difference in the cost of living in that region. But I would not want to see it get to a point where every county has a separate minimum wage. I think that would be far too disruptive economically and you know, a patchwork where employers would have to monitor it. But I think it'll continue to be an issue until we get to the point where it's indexed.
Yeah, so a couple of points here. We've had economists on this program, some members of the Republican Party who have not supported attaching it to inflation, and they tell us, well, there are certain questions about could that be manipulated, et cetera. And I always feel like that's just letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. Because,
yeah, no,
of course, little things could be manipulated, but,
it's hard
but
to
it
manipulate.
Is true.
It's hard
every
to
year, if you don't get an increase, you are getting a pay cut every year just based on inflation. And until we fix that, we're going to be doing this in perpetuity.
Right. And what's going to happen is every few years there's going to be a big push to raise the minimum wage, and employers will have to adjust to a significant increase rather than just being able to budget in. Rate of inflation right now is less than 2%. But when it gets up to 4%, you know, that purchasing power will continue to be eaten away. If you buy the argument that we should have a minimum wage, and I think that's pretty well been, adjudicated publicly and otherwise in this country, then it makes perfect sense that minimum wage ought to continue to stay current with in terms of its purchasing power.
But is there any hope that attaching it to inflation will happen next year or anytime soon? Do you feel like there's any momentum for that at all?
Well, I will say this, that I think even Republican members of the Senate recognize, as much as they opposed increasing the minimum wage now, they recognize, look, it is popular. I think the public wants an increase in the minimum wage. I don't know that anybody would agree necessarily on the level at which it ought to be. But I think they recognize that it's an important thing to do. So I could see this being a part of next year's budget or being taken up in the session next year and some resolution. I would certainly hope so.
And when it comes to the minimum wage in different sectors, the governor has a wage board. Well, let's kind of work through this here. The wage board has been looking at what we call the fight for 15. The fast food workers have said they want $15 an hour. First of all, very simply, $15 an hour for fast food workers, excessive, fair? What do you think?
Well, I'll get into a lot of trouble here. I would prefer not to have certain sectors have individual minimum wages. I think that's, asking for trouble. It's actually trying to address a real concern that people have. But look, what I fear, what the end product of that will be more automation and fewer jobs in that sector. I know that there are a number of fast food chains already experimenting with more robotics, in an effort to try to not only have consistency and to speed up delivery. I mean, frankly, I think McDonald's as a national effort is really looking at the lag times now. It's really hard to call it fast food any longer in some McDonald's. I think they're looking at automation already. This will just further that. I think the real secret here is not so much to try to engineer the economy through, different industries, et cetera. We need to do a much better job at improving the skill sets of young people who have been disenfranchised. That's really the challenge here. If you look in Rochester, in our metro region, there are something like 15,000 middle-skill jobs going wanting. Those pay far more than $15 an hour and, in some cases, decent benefits and an opportunity for a career ladder. But they go wanting because people don't have the skills. Middle skills doesn't mean you have to have a college degree. It means you have to have somewhere between a high school diploma and a two-year degree, some kind of certification. That will really drive self-sufficiency. So, whatever the minimum wage is going to be, I think it ought to be applied across industries. I think it ought to have an index in it. I think it ought to be raised at the end of the schedule. I would prefer not to see individual sectors of the economy have specific minimum wages because I just think it leads to unintended consequences.
And so I think you've answered Matt's question on Twitter. He says, why fast food workers getting 15 an hour and not child care workers? Your point would be...
Yeah, exactly that. It's that I think when you start looking at individual industries, you're going to run into disparities that you didn't intend. And I think that's problematic. There ought to be a minimum wage. I think it ought to be indexed. And I think we ought to work very hard at workforce development and other issues and other initiatives like the one we're doing here in Rochester to prepare better people better for the workplace.
We saw the wage board recommend tipped service workers see their wage rise, and it did from $5 to $7.50, I think. And now, so they're looking at this issue. Are you comfortable with the wage board in general, Joe?
Well, I think the wage board has its place. I would argue that big public policy issues like the ones they're taking on, I think, are a little bit unintended. I don't think that's what they were designed to do, and I think the legislature and the governor ought to do this and set these as a matter of public policy.
Have you let the governor know that? I mean, have you said that this is not the right way to do it?
Actually, I don't think he and I have talked. We've talked about many issues over the years. I don't know that we've ever had a conversation about the role of the wage board.
And I'm not trying to create a controversy. I'm just trying to make sure I understand that. Because right now we could be going down this road. I mean, what could be coming out of the wage board right now? Could this happen?
Well, from everything I've heard, and that's mostly through press reports, it could very well come out that fast food workers, and however you define that,
and that's another question.
Right, will be paid a much higher wage than the minimum wage. I mean, it will be an increase of $6 plus, just if you work at Burger King instead of working at DSW selling shoes. So that's a big. It's interesting. It will make those jobs far more attractive. You'll have a lot more applicants at Burger King and Wendy's than you do now. And it will hurt other retailers who will be, basically struggling to get the same, young people largely. And remember, although people talk about minimum wage is not a living wage, I don't think the minimum wage was ever intended to be a living wage. It really was the first rung on a career ladder or first exposure to the workplace. And so I understand people's concerns about income inequality and the disparity between high wage, high income earners in the United States and low income earners. But I think there are other ways to structurally address this rather than trying to do this method, which is just picking winners and losers.
All right, let me grab Paul in Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Question that I'm hoping Mr. Morelli can help me with. I see in our local newspapers a lot of times in articles regarding the comptroller, Mr. DiNapoli, announcing results of audits where he finds waste in different areas of the government, but I rarely see any articles on the follow-up on what happened, what's been done to either make some improvements or change some people. And I'm just curious if Mr. Morelli might have some insight on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, thanks. I think typically local governments will use those audits to improve not only, in some cases, their financial management, but also operationally what they're doing right or wrong. And to ignore a comptroller's audit is to create at least accountability questions for you. And that comes to ultimately at the ballot box, those town board members or other county legislators, whatever the level of government is, who ignore audits, I think face a great deal of criticism. There is less enforcement power in the comptroller's office than you would think, although when there's real problems, as we have seen in Monroe County, the audits that related, for instance, the local development corporations were turned over to the attorney general's office and have resulted in indictments. So I think people want to make sure that they are consistent with the findings of an audit, and we do it both through the political process as well as the law enforcement process where it's extreme.
Here's the great reporter Karen DeWitt for WXXI with a headline on WXXINews.org right now. Critics say rebate checks won't really cut taxes. She cites E.J. McMahon of the Empire Center and others saying that the new rebate checks, which will range from around $200 to several hundred dollars, are akin to Frankenstein's monster. She said that this is just the Star Property Tax Relief Plan coming back, and that the checks do not represent an actual cut in property taxes. Joe?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, we have clearly seen a dramatic decline in the growth in property tax increases over the last several years since we've had the property tax cap in place. So that's one dimension of our efforts to try to control property taxes, and that has been very effective indeed. And look, this property tax rebate is $1.3 billion when fully implemented in the next 4 years. If we were talking about raising property taxes $1.3 billion, I dare say E.J. McMahon would call that a tax increase. So for him to suggest that it's not a break in property taxes, I think, is disingenuous. Is it everything we'd like it to be? No. But it is a dramatic shift in just the last few years when you combine both the rebates, the STAR program. And frankly, I think this is a way of making sure that we replace a regressive property tax through the STAR program and other programs that we've created and replacing it with a far more progressive state income tax system. So I'm not displeased with it at all. In fact, I think the vote on this bill that passed the last night of the session had something like 116 or 120 yes votes. So it was both Democrats and Republicans thinking that this is, in fact, a way to address property tax concerns.
Sue in Fairport is next with Joe Morelli. Go ahead, Sue.
Hi. I'm not in your district, but I have called your office, and I have to say that you have one of the nicest staffs of any of the representatives, and particularly Arlie.
Oh, Arlie is legendary.
He is extraordinary. I don't think I'm the only one who feels that way.
I know. Well, I feel like I'm like missing the inside baseball. What's the breaking news here? Who's Arlie?
Arlie and Jimmy and Sam in my office are three people who everybody deals with constituent issues, but the three of them do it exceptionally well. I'm blessed to have great people to work with, and Arlie's a great employee who's, I think he feels very, very emotional about the complaints that people raise with us, as do our staff, and they work very, very hard to try to resolve these. So it's very nice of you to say that, Sue.
He has always provided me with the best information, and I called every representative in the area because of the tax credit, which I found so abhorrent. that I just had to call everyone, and I felt that anybody who voted for this or advocated for it was no better than the pedophiles and those who protected them. But I had to combine that with something very positive, and Arlie and your staff were very positive.
Well, that's good. Hopefully they're listening as they're doing constituent work. So Arlie,
they can listen later.
Exactly, that's true.
On a recording or maybe they're recording this.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sue. That's very nice. A lot of staff members. There's one sitting in this room next to Joe who never gets public credit anyway. That's just the way these things go.
He tries to make me look good, which is a tall order, so I'm not sure how well he's doing.
We're talking to Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader. And Joe, 10 years from now, what is more likely? 10 years from now, we see one out of every 10 houses in the Rochester area has solar panels on the roof, or fracking is rocking in New York State and fracking is actually happening. What's more likely in 10 years?
I think it's more likely that you'll see solar panels on one out of every 10 houses. I think fracking has still too many unanswered questions, as evidenced by a report out of DEC, the Department of Environmental Conservation and Health Department. I think some of the things that you're seeing in Pennsylvania, the long-term implications, I think, are causing people to really be concerned about it. This debate will go on, but at least in New York for the time being and for the foreseeable future, you're not going to see it.
And you're saying got it right, you think?
I do think we've got it right.
Okay. Joel wants to know, let me scroll back here. Joel says, I'm sorry. Now I've got to get back to the start here. Joel just wanted to know why it seems like there's so much animal legislation that goes nowhere on the state level. He didn't specify, but I think animal protection, animal rights, et cetera.
Well, animal protection, it's amazing to me at times. I'm going to get in trouble, I'm sure, that there are as many bills as there are. There is a lot of interest, obviously, in pets. This year, for instance, we famously passed a bill which will allow restaurants at their prerogative to allow an outdoor seating pets to accompany restaurant patrons. So that was something that people worked on. There are a number of bills. Obviously, people are concerned about the treatment of animals and pets, and it does garner a lot of attention. I actually think, it's probably the percentage of those bills enacted as a total of all those introduced may be small, but I think we do spend a fair amount of time on the issue and making sure that we're being as progressive as we can be.
The number of New Yorkers who have registered their assault rifles is pretty low. 44,500, according to the latest numbers released by the state after SCOPE, the Shooters Committee on Political Education, asked for those numbers. And police estimate, along with the gun industry, these estimates are around a million assault-style rifles or assault-style weapons exist in this state, and only about 44,500, or about 4.5%, have been registered. SCOPE says that is evidence that the SAFE Act is being ignored. It is not working. And when you look at that actual number, I mean, Joe, that is a very low number. Does it say to you that the act is being ignored?
Well, I think it says to me that some people should be registering their weapons.
People who aren't?
Well, if there's a, if the, I mean, I honestly, I would have no independent knowledge of whether or not there's a million assault-style weapons in New York and only 40,000. Obviously, we could check how many are being registered. I don't know about the million number. I think, look, I know that people would like it repealed. I know people like Senator Funky here has spent a lot of time and energy on repeal. I don't think it's ever going to be repealed. I think there are a lot of elements of the SAFE Act which are sound and make great sense. I think there are a couple of adjustments I might have made, but I on the whole, I think it makes a great sense. There's just too much gun violence in New York. I think even those who oppose the SAFE Act would agree. They might disagree on why there's as much violence as there is, but we have a lot of guns in the state, and I think they ought to be registered. I think we ought to know who has them, and I think people who have had histories of mental illness should be concerned about them having weapons. So we'll continue to work on this issue, and I'm not sure how we would enforce it if local law enforcement isn't making an effort. But and I think there is some resistance in some parts of the state to the law enforcement really being aggressive about it. And I don't think that was the intent, to be aggressive. You know, I think there were horror stories by some of my colleagues about how we would be sending police door to door to register weapons. Look, a lot of legislation is voluntary compliance. We hope people will comply, and over time we'll get most of these weapons registered.
There's a difference between police being aggressive in enforcing and law enforcement essentially not enforcing. Are you concerned that there are some patches of law enforcement in this state that are ignoring this act or not enforcing it roughly at all?
Well, I don't know that certainly firsthand, and I wouldn't say that, but I do note that there have been some people in law enforcement who have publicly and privately criticized the law. And so, you know, I assume everybody who's sworn to uphold the law will enforce it. But, you know, question of their enthusiasm for doing it may be at different levels in different parts of the state.
Jennifer writes to us, can Mr. Morelli update us on where Common Core stands and his position on it?
Well, you know, Common Core, I think it's often misunderstood. I think Common Core, which is a set of standards, is something that we ought to continue to work to try to implement in the state. I've often said I think the implementation of the Common Core standards has been badly done. I don't think there were enough resources in classrooms. I don't think there was enough time in order for classroom teachers both to be trained in it and to implement it. I think it has become, you know, sort of popular to say that the Common Core ought to be removed or disbanded. But I think there's a great deal of wisdom in the Common Core. It's just getting the implementation right, which is, by the way, a big but and a big, you know, this is a big thing. Hopefully we'll continue to work at it, and you know, in a decade from now, people will say, you know, more robust standards in a world which is going to be increasingly competitive, increasingly difficult for our young people to compete in, that those will have been benefits to our children, both in terms of their educational achievement and their future employment.
Okay. Last week, we talked to the former CEO of CenturySafe, Jim Brush, on this program. CenturySafe, a company that was founded in 1930 and had been making safes in our area and has been for more than 80 years. Master Lock bought the company a year ago. The Brushes really tell us they really did believe that the company was going to stay here, that Master Lock made a commitment, that they saw the value, that the benefit, and instead Master Lock announced last week, no, that there many of those jobs will go, 350 jobs, many will go to Mexico, some will go to Wisconsin. And Jim Brush said they succeeded here, but it is still a tough business climate, and that they were disappointed by this, but Master Lock is saying they couldn't be competitive here. Does that concern you? I know you have worked very, very hard on economic development, bringing in companies, bringing in jobs. Does the CenturySafe story stand out as an outlier, or is that a red flag for you?
No, I think our competitiveness continues to be an issue. I think we've done a much better job, and I do think the governor has been dedicated to particularly upstate economic revitalization. You know, one of the things that you could argue, and this is cold comfort to anyone, but CenturySafe was very successful. That's why they became a target to be purchased by another company. And as often the case we've seen with Bausch & Lomb, we've seen with other employers in this community, when you get purchased by a national or global organization, you know, typically they're looking to cut costs, still serve those customers, but that's part of the attraction. So in a sense, we become victims of their success. But in a broader sense, Startup New York, which I know has come under a great deal of criticism, but I think if we just stick with it, you're going to see real benefits. I think the upstate revitalization effort And I think Rochester is well poised to be successful in that competition. I think a lot of good things are happening in our region. The redevelopment of Eastman Business Park. I think what's going on at RIT and the U of R in terms of research and products. I think there are real opportunities on the horizon. We just got to stick with it. To your point, I think we still need to think about the competitiveness of this state. We're never going to be the lowest cost state to do business in. It's just not realistic. But we need to continue to put downward pressure so we go at least in the middle of the pack in terms of how we're rated compared to other states when people are looking for expansion, looking for where they're going to put those jobs.
And last minute, Startup New York has, as you said, come under a lot of criticism in the first 6 months of this year. It's still relatively young. The executive director of that program came on the show and said, you are judging this program before it can really get moving, and that 2 to 3 to 5 years from now, it's going to be a different story. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I was one of its biggest supporters in the legislature, in the debate in the legislature. I'll continue to say that the bringing together entrepreneurs and our very vibrant, very excellent higher education system and research facilities is the real secret, particularly in upstate New York. But you need to give it time. This is not something that's going to be a success in the first year. I think 5 years, 10 years from now, people will look back and say, wow, I shouldn't have been so quick to criticize it. It really has produced significant benefits for our region.
Joe Morelli is the Assembly Majority Leader and always takes time for this program following a session to kind of give us a recap and answer your questions. Got through a lot this hour, and thank you. Thank you for the time.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. Always nice to be with you.
Always appreciate that. And a lot coming up here. As you heard them talk about the Anti-Poverty Initiative with some of their reports and recommendations starting to come in over the next coming days, we'll be covering that with the Assembly Majority Leader and so many people involved with that as well here. Thanks for listening to the program. Thanks to Engineer Val LaBanca, Caitlin Madison, the intern extraordinaire for this program, and I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.